In the piles and piles of general film histories that I use to do my research for this show, movies made in the United States and the national industry that created them get the lion's share of the words. Films made in other nations are often treated with much more brevity, combined and covered in a few chapters or paragraphs here and there. At least in one book, the author gives the impression that in the golden age of silent cinema, an era we will soon be jumping headlong into, the rest of the world's filmmakers were merely playing with the US's toys. This is not true. I want to be very clear about that. People of all ethnicities and nationalities produce astonishingly beautiful and innovative movies, and have done so ever since they've had access to cameras. That said, why do so many writers seem to feel this way about film made in the US? Largely, I think it's because most of the movies in the world were made in the United States at the time, meaning that it can just seem like there's more to write about. Going back to episode 16, 80% of all of the movies in the world were coming out of the state of California by 1919. While for decades the US would maintain its numeric dominance, it wasn't predestined. For a while, it looked like sunny Italy just might become the center of the cinematic world. If you really think about it, you can see it. Italy has a climate that is great for movies. It's got year-round sunny weather, fairly easy access to beautiful and diverse landscapes, majestic ruins, and a long history of art and literature to draw on. In the early years of film, all of these advantages worked like you might expect they would, and would lead David A. Cook to write that no country was more responsible for the rise of the feature film than Italy. So, taking all of this into account, what happened? How did Rome gain and then lose its early lead and see Hollywood, California become the capital of a worldwide film empire? And before its decline as an international film powerhouse, what was Italy's impact on the young medium of film? Answering these questions are what the next few episodes are going to be about. We'll plot our course from Italy's early filmmakers and movies, through one of the world's first great film movements, and into the political and economic factors that would temporarily cripple Italian filmmaking in the international and domestic markets. We begin today. This is the 20th episode of the History of Film, The Rise of the Roman Film Empire.
No story ever written for the screen is as dramatic as the story of the screen itself.
As we've learned several times since episode 1, film history predates film history. That's just as true in Italy as it was anywhere else. As early as the 18th century, there are records of crowds of people gathering to see a small device we haven't yet described on this show, called the Mondo Nuovo, or the New World. This was a magic lantern that would project its image not on a large wall, but in a small box, which a viewer would peer into. This, of course, is reminiscent of the Edison-Dixon kinetoscope peep show devices that would usher in the earliest widespread exhibition of moving pictures. The mechanical wonder of the Mondo Nuovo would show anxious crowds far-off locations and even some purposeful misrepresentations of familiar sights, meant to amuse and delight. All of the other advancements that led to film in episode 1 and 2 found their way to Italy before the dawn of the 20th century. And just as in France and the United States, Italy was about to expand into another new world. Cinema. Motion pictures began in Italy in 1895, the same year that the Lumiere brothers would show their first cinematographic presentations in Paris. In November of that year, a man named Filippo Albertini would register a patent for a motion picture device that has come to be known as the Albertini kinetograph. The sources I have access to are a bit unclear, but it seems likely to me that it was this device which was used to produce the first commercially shown Italian film. King Umberto and Margherita of Savoy stroll through the park the very next year in 1896. Interestingly, no less a source than Wikipedia, translated from Italian to English, claims that the film was lost, rediscovered in 1979, and then lost again. So, though through a comedy of errors we can't see this particular movie, we can see others like it. The early films of Italy, like those of early France, were usually charming actualités. These early Italian films were clearly influenced by those shown by the Lumiere brothers, who sent out their first missionaries bearing the good news of the cinematograph to Italy in 1896. Interestingly, our old friend W.K. L. Dixon makes an appearance in 1896 as well, recording the aged Pope Leo XIII blessing an audience. From the perspective of someone watching the movie, it looks like the Pope is blessing them directly. It is a powerful image, even a quarter of a century later, and is an interesting example of the connection that exists between religion and film, which will come up many more times in this show. After this, what we can learn about Italian film for almost a decade kind of drops off a cliff. Most sources either barely mention this very early period or omit it entirely. This appears to be because, as far as many writers are concerned, Italian movies don't really become any fun until about 1905. That is the year that our friend Filippo Albertini strides back into the story. The public appetite for movies in Italy was increasing. By 1906, film exhibition had moved out of the realm of traveling exhibitioners plying their trade in schools and stadia, and into brick-and-mortar dedicated movie theaters. Also by 1906, at least two major Italian cities had more than 20 movie houses, less than what we've seen developing in the United States at the same period, but still an impressive market. A market that inventor Albertini was looking to tap. He did so, constructing his own studio Cines, I think I'm pronouncing that right, but I don't know anything about Italian, in the city of Rome in 1905 and 1906. It was there that the movie which would set the precedent for Italian cinema's international prominence would be produced, the 1905 film The Capture of Rome. The Capture of Rome tells the story of the surrender of the city of Rome as a papal territory in 1870, at the battle which would secure the final unification of Italy. And if you're anything like me, when you watch The Capture of Rome, you'll notice two things. The first is, for being from 1905, this is pretty good. The sets and costumes are just as elaborate as the filmed art movies in France, which would be released years later, but the acting is better, and the story is generally more visually exciting. More importantly, as a movie from 1905, the action sequences are impressive early examples of depth in film. When Italian army troops breach the walls of Rome and begin to flood into the city, moving from the front of the space being filmed to the back of it, it creates an impressive long shot. We've actually seen an opening shot very visually similar to this one before. Think back to the opening of the 1901 James Williamson film Fire, which we saw in episode 8. But The Capture of Rome extends this shot and fills the screen with 100 soldiers instead of one firefighter. This kind of spatial depth is used in a shot where cannons are fired at the walls of Rome to make it an impressive little movie. The second thing that you'll notice is the film is not quite all there. It's possible a more intact print of the film exists, and I was only able to find an incomplete version, but as far as I can tell, we only have stills for the cannon firing scene and the closing shot of the film. Just looking at the intertitles, it also seems like there might be entire sequences missing, but I'm not sure. It's sad that such an important film exists only in pieces, but I guess we'll take what we can get. C'est la vie. The movie The Capture of Rome would set Italian cinema on the course to developing its most influential and popular early genre, the historical epic. While this period would see many Italian studios produce light comedies and contemporary melodramas, it was in making movies that drew on Italy's rich cultural reservoirs of history and art that would propel its national film industry into international prominence. And the next movie that would do so was Luigi Maggi's The Last Days of Pompeii from 1908. The Last Days of Pompeii can be a bit obtuse, and I benefited from looking up a summary of the movie just to make sure I understood who all the characters are, but when looking at the visuals of the movie, it really does stand out. Massive painted backgrounds make the architecture of ancient Rome both imposing and impressive, and give the audience the sense that the characters in the movie and their concerns are ultimately small compared to the historical and natural cataclysm which we know looms over them. When Mount Vesuvius finally erupts, dooming the people of Pompeii to their terrible fate, the smoke and fog that creep in from the side of the screen represent a major use of special effects in early film. It reminds me of the creeping fog that is the Angel of Death from Cecil B. DeMille's movie The Ten Commandments, made in 1956. The ash also represents how spectacle can work really well with the characters and plot of a film. The blind, enslaved woman who is key to the film in many ways is able to use her experience navigating the world without sight in order to save her owner, who she is also in love with. The resolution of the movie works really well because of how the spectacle was integrated into the film, rather than simply added on top of it. We'll see this done well and poorly for the rest of film history. There are other parts of the movie that don't make as much sense, like a poison that doesn't kill you but makes you go crazy for a little while, I guess? The Last Days of Pompeii is not a perfect film, by any means. But its release did turn the attention of Italian filmmakers ever more to the ancient past of Italy, and to ever greater spectacle in order to catch the attention of ever-growing audiences. The Last Days of Pompeii touched off a cinematic arms race that would lead Italian production companies to make many so-called sword and sandal epics. These movies would lead Italy's film industry to become, arguably, the most important film-producing country in the world at the time. It would be hard to overstate just how important these movies were and are, and also how many of them there were. It would be impossible to talk about all of them, so we'll discuss the history and impact of two or three of them next week, at least the 1913 movies Quo Vadis and Cabiria, but hopefully more. And as for the rest of today's episode, we'll spend our time talking about another movie rooted in Italy's history and culture that took a different path to bring audiences into theaters. A path through hell itself. The 1911 film The Inferno had three directors named, get ready, Bertolini, De Liguario, and Patavone, three names that I am sure I said with grace and skill. Like many of the longer films coming out of France and Italy in 1910, this movie still uses mise-en-scène rather than editing to move audiences through its story. It consists of mostly stage-like long shots, showing the audience the actor's entire body all at once. Something that we're going to be seeing for at least a little while longer, and it doesn't have much of a real story, instead following the familiar poem of Dante's Inferno, showing audiences the surreal, nightmare-like world of hell that Dante describes. And so far, this isn't really news to us. We've spent multiple episodes now describing adaptations of literary works and classic tales made in this early style of cinema, using few camera movements and little continuity editing. But what makes this movie stand out is its use of special effects to create the environments and creatures that the film's protagonists, Dante and Virgil, move through and face. The Inferno is the most amazing use of effects filmmaking we've seen since Georges Méliès all the way back in episode 7. Let's describe a little bit of it so you can get an idea. On his way through hell, Dante encounters strange animal monster puppets, including a long-necked three-headed dog, the famous Cerberus of myth, which guards the gluttonous in hell. While the Cerberus puppet looks a bit like a scary llama, he also meets impressively realistic puppets of a lion and a panther. The use of realistic puppets remains an important part of effects filmmaking to this day. While obviously not invented in Italy, we've seen skeletons dance in French film after all, the animal puppets in this movie represent a step forward in their use in cinema. While touring through hell, Dante and Virgil encounter giants. These beings look enormous because of something called forced perspective, a filmmaking technique which takes advantage of the limited view provided by the camera to make objects seem bigger or smaller than they actually are in relation to other objects on the screen. In the Inferno, this is accomplished by putting the camera low to the ground, making the actors playing the giants seem extra tall. At the same time, the film's protagonists enter the frame in the background of the shot, which is carefully planned in such a way to make them look like they're simply smaller than the creatures that dominate the frame. With a well-placed cut, Dante and his companion were replaced with models of themselves, allowing the giants to look like they were picking them up and putting them down. All of this made for an impressive show, and is also exactly how the hobbits in The Lord of the Rings were made to look small, and how Hagrid in the Harry Potter series was made to look big. While less sophisticated, and less convincing than we see in 21st century high-budget movie franchises, we can see the origins of that technique here. The uses of masking and double exposure in The Inferno are the best we have ever seen. There's one scene in particular in which Dante and Virgil are being ferried across a river in the pits of hell, where the actual horizon line of the shot was masked, preventing that part of the film from being exposed, and then later that masking was reversed, exposing the previously unexposed film to something much stranger. In the final completed shot, looming over the body of water are mountains set against a black sky, with the smoke of brimstone rising behind them. The overwhelming despair conveyed from this use of special effects is still impressive. And The Inferno does this over and over and over again. It is filled with the bodies of the tormented, nearly naked and writhing in agony in almost every shot of the film. Though likely actors were reused from shot to shot, it gives the audience the impression of the numberless concourses of hell that populate this nightmare world. Strange and surreal images are presented to the audience again and again. Bodies are half buried upside down, just a pair of legs wiggling in the air. We see a man frozen in ice gnawing on a decapitated skull. Real pyrotechnics are used to make fire rain from the sky. There are bat-winged demons which float over a river of filth, and even a giant Satan consuming the bodies of traitors. It is a wild movie, and it had an impact on the film of Italy. According to Peter Bonadella, who quite literally wrote the book on Italian film in English, there were no less than 11 film adaptations of Inferno between 1908 and 1911. And this is the one that stuck, and it's easy to see why. The 1911 Inferno we just described broke the record for the longest film made in Italy, reaching a length of over 1,300 meters. It was also the most expensive Italian film made to that point, costing over 100,000 livre, and boy oh boy can you tell. The sets of the Inferno aren't just paintings, which of necessity left backgrounds of movies like The Last Days of Pompeii strangely and obviously empty, but massive spaces constructed with literal depth and were filled with people and things to look at. Added to this distinct style of visual opulence, the use of massive casts, lavish special effects, and one of the first major film advertising campaigns in Italian history combined to make The Inferno succeed in one of its primary goals, making cinema a high-class experience in Italy. The premiere of The Inferno was attended by some of the most famous members of Italy's intelligentsia, including philosophers, writers, and critics. It's hard, and maybe even wrong, to draw lines in history. But I would say that as of The Inferno, movies were officially cool for rich people in Italy to be seen attending. While The Inferno was important in its own right, its greatest place in the history of film would be in the standard it would set for all movies that came after it. Now, if people wanted to make impressive, immersive, and important film, large, deep, and richly detailed sets would be a requirement, not a nicety. After all, how important can a film be if it's a visual desert compared to the deep rivers of illustrative filmmaking seen in movies that came before it? Movies like The Inferno. The Inferno whetted the appetites of Italian filmmakers and filmgoers for a spectacle film, whose visual merits would be unsurpassed anywhere in the world. To meet this audience need, filmmakers would turn their cameras even further back than the poetic pages of Dante by more than 1,000 years. After all, if the flames of hell could attract audience members in their pocketbooks, then just imagine what Roman flames could do. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The History of Film. As of this week, we are officially back on a weekly schedule, so you can look forward to a new episode next Monday. That means that next week we get to talk about some major feature films. This is a big step forward in our journey and will lead directly to our next topic after we leave the sunny shores of Italy. Instead of a favorite fact that didn't make it into the show this week, I have a suggestion. Look up the current quote-unquote royal family of Italy. It's one of the craziest things I've ever heard about. Italy doesn't actually even have a royal family, but the people who would have been the crown princes of the Italian nation, had their monarchy not been abolished, still pretend that it does, and fight amongst themselves for their imaginary crown. As I was doing research on the first films made in Italy and learned about King Umberto and Margherita of Savoy stroll through the park, the story of the current supposed monarchs of Italy came to mind. And as much as I would like to see the King Umberto actualité, and as much as I would like to see that first actualité of King Umberto, what I would really like to see is a full documentary about their descendants. If you are new here, please consider subscribing and leaving a review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. More than anything, that helps out the show and lets me know what you think. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at historyoffilmpodcast@gmail.com, and you can visit the show's website, historyoffilmpodcast.com, to access resources for this and other episodes. Thank you so much for listening, and join me next week for another exciting episode of The History of Film.